Pod is a ministry of Grace Church Greenwich. For more resources to help you get to know God better through His Word, including bite-sized theology and answers to big questions, do check out www.greenwich.church. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello and welcome to Grace Pod, and we are today in Ezekiel, and we're in chapters 1 and then chapters 8 to 10. And we mentioned last time some of these studies are in pairs. So this one pairs with the previous one because the content is the same. They're both about the Lord's judgment on his people, sending them out into exile. But as you'll hear in a moment, the genre, the style of writing could not be more different. So whereas the other one was history, this one is psychedelic vision. It's one of the craziest, most vivid pictures that you get. Ezekiel was a prophet who painted in very impressionist tones.
It's just an amazing chapter. I mean, one of the best things we could do with this podcast is just to read chapter one, which I guess we need to resist the temptation because you can read it yourself, but please do. But I'll just read a bit of it at the beginning. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with brightness round it, fire flashing forth continuously. In the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. This was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces. Each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight. The soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands. And the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each one had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had the face of an ox on the left side. The four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. And it goes on and describes the wheels that this is mounted on and how the rims of the wheels were covered in eyes. And then above them, there's an expanse like crystal. And above that, there's fire. And it overloads the senses.
I guess if we are used to the New Testament, this is most like reading Revelation. And
it's very, very like Revelation because John gets a lot of his vision of Revelation by meditating on this, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess one of the keys to reading it, as we've probably mentioned when doing Revelation in the past, is it's not so much a code as an impression. So one of the things to encourage as you read it is don't worry if you don't pick up every detail, but at the end of it, just what do you feel? And the sense that you get is part of the communication, this sense of the Lord's utter transcendence and glory and sovereignty. And there will be some, you know, clues as we look at the details, but overall it just leaves you stunned.
And actually Ezekiel himself makes clear that this isn't some kind of photograph or video of what God looks like. Because at the end of it, he says, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. I remember someone saying, this is not the glory of the Lord. It's not even the likeness of the glory of the Lord. It's the appearance of the likeness. So he's saying, like, I can't really describe it, but this is as close as I can get in words.
Yeah. And as we go through, one of the things that is striking at the beginning is the setting. So one of the things we know about Ezekiel is he's a priest, and that's relevant because we're going to see he's very interested in worship and in the temple. But it's a particularly sad thing to be a priest when you are away from the temple. So he's been exiled. He's by the banks of the Kibar River. He's in modern Iraq or Babylon. And this is sad for anyone. But if you're a priest, this is your, there's no way you can follow your vocation. Your whole reason to be is negated.
And yet, here he is in exile, and then God comes to him, and God shows up in exile, as if to say, this is weird, isn't it? Because we're about to see God's glory abandon Jerusalem and abandon the temple, but God's glory has come to be with his faithful people in exile. I guess the Ezekiels and the Daniels of the world, those who are actually faithful to God, the remnant, despite being carried along with the judgment on the whole nation.
And even the day that it happens on, so the opening words of Ezekiel are in the 30th year. And some people, commentators, disagree as to what this is the 30th year from. But I think Christopher Wright's explanation makes sense to me, which is that it's the 30th year of the prophet's life. This is the year when he would be consecrated as priest.
Because at priest you start from age 30.
Exactly, and Jesus began his ministry age 30. It's the normal age when you begin your professional life. And so this would have been a particularly sad time. He's thinking about how my life would have been different if the exile hadn't happened. And it's on that day the Lord says, I'm coming to you. And actually the last verse, the last word of verse 3, says, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest in the land of the Chaldeans, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. And I think the emphasis is on that final word. Of all the places, God has come to him in the place which would be most distant from the temple.
Now, as we see this vision of God, or this vision of God's throne, there's a few things that are emphasized. And what I love about this, it's kind of a brilliant way of writing a prophecy or giving a vision. It's like a film where you get all these elements in it and you don't really understand why they're important yet. But as the book goes on, we go, oh, that's why I saw this, or that's why. I don't know if you're a fan of Better Call Saul. I love the Vince Gilligan, the film director, but he always does this. The opening scene is always some image and you can't understand why it fits in. And then later you go, ah, I got it. And it's a bit like that. So let's just notice in chapter one some of these motifs. And then when we turn to chapter 8 to 10, we'll see, oh, that's why we were told that. So I guess I'll start. The first one, I guess you see, is God's glory. I mean, God is just incredibly majestic. And it's not even a vision where Ezekiel sees God, because, well, it says in John's gospel, doesn't it? No one has ever seen God. And people say, oh, but what about Ezekiel? But actually, Ezekiel doesn't really see God, because the vision, it starts at the bottom and then he gradually looks higher and higher and higher and higher. So he starts with the wheels at the bottom of the chariot, and then he has the expanse above them. And then above that, there's a throne, and above that, there's fire. But he only gets as far as the waist, actually. He never actually sees God. But even seeing God's throne and God's waist is overwhelmingly glorious. So the first motif, glory.
Another one to pick, you notice there's a lot of references to wheels, which is odd, not a big thing in our doctrine of God usually, that we think about God's wheels. But he's on, I guess, a sort of a chariot. And
so it's not a throne, actually. It's a mobile throne, i.e. a chariot.
Exactly. And we there's all kinds of descriptions of the wheels that make it move in all different directions. And the idea, I think, is dynamism, that the Lord is not constrained. He's not static, but he's, well, we'll come and see later why this is significant in Ezekiel's vision later. But it's the great dynamism of the living God who acts.
The wheels are powered by the spirit of the living creatures. And these living creatures have got these four faces. They're a lion's face, an ox face, an eagle's face, and a human face. And I guess to notice this just at this stage, these are very glorious animals. So it's not the face of a cocker spaniel, the face of a beetle, it's the lion, the most majestic of the wild animals. It's an eagle, the most majestic of the birds. It's an ox, the most powerful of the domestic animals. And then it's a human, obviously the pinnacle of God's creation, made in God's image. So God is enthroned above his creation, above the creatures that he's made.
Yeah. One of the other features, which is an older one, it says in verse 18 about the wheels, their rims were tall and awesome. The rims of all four were full of eyes all round. I think this is not a normal kind of wheel, a kind of wheel that has eyes everywhere. But I guess the image is all seeing. And we're going to see that God, despite the people thinking that they can hide from him and that they can sin with impunity, it turns out the Lord is watching everything.
And then finally, there's a lot of fire. There's gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire. Downwards was somewhat the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it was the appearance of fire. So to put it all together, we've noticed glory, wheels, eyes, fire. I've missed one out.
Hierarchy.
And yeah, creation, eagles, lions, etc. Okay, so wow, what an amazing vision. But then, as we say, when we get further into Ezekiel, we start to see the significance of some of these things. So let's go to chapter 8. And we've now gone from Babylon, from the Kibar Canal, into Jerusalem. And the first thing I suppose to notice is that God is there. God's glory is there. So there's a the God who is present with Ezekiel is present in Jerusalem and about to act.
And we get a little tour of the temple first off. And what we see is, I think, a little bit disturbing, but it's all the more disturbing when we put it in the context of the glorious vision of chapter one. So, some of the details to pick out are, do you want to take us to this, the weirdness of what's happening?
Well, it's a weird image in verse 8. Son of man, so that's Ezekiel's title. God says to him, son of man, dig in the wall. And he digs in the wall and there's a hidden entrance. So it's like this secret room somewhere within the temple that's sort of plastered over. And when he goes in, God says, go in and see the vile abominations that they are committing there. And I went in and saw, and there engraved on the wall all round was every form of creeping things and loathsome beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel. So I guess this makes us think in chapter one of God was enthroned above the eagle, the lion, the ox and the man. But here it's a complete inversion of creation hierarchy, that humans, instead of worshipping God, are now worshipping, well, they're not even worshipping eagles or lions, they're worshipping millipedes or unclean animals. So it's the idolatry as an overturning of creation order and hierarchy.
And is it relevant that this is being written by a priest? So I think we find creeping things and loathsome beasts a bit off-putting, but if, perhaps if your whole life is about purity and cleanliness, and I think Ezekiel is trying to explain the horror of what's happened in Israel's history, but he puts it in a particular language, which is a priestly language. What has happened is impure and creepy and off-putting.
So we've God's glory, instead of above the creation, God's glory being subordinated to loathsome, unclean beasts. And then they say, so God says to Ezekiel, have you seen what they do? They say, the Lord does not see us. And you're like, what? Have you no idea that his chariot is, the rims of the wheels are covered in eyes? So we know that God is all seeing, but they think that God can't see. And you just think they're so naive. They've just forgotten that God knows what's going on everywhere, including in the little hidden room in the wall.
And this is similar to our last study. We were thinking, how did Israel get to this state? How did they ignore the warnings and do this idolatry? But this is one of the steps along the way. It's the step of, well, God won't notice. He barely pays us any attention. And the absurdity of that is what Ezekiel's pulling out. You know, he has 20/20 vision on everything that happens. Don't be absurd.
So God's judgment's coming, but then you had a few little nuances to it, or a few sub themes about God's judgment. And in chapter 9, the first thing we see is, even though God's judgment's coming, it's not universal. There is a way to escape it. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, so this is in chapter 9 we get a strange scene again where there's a mark protecting someone from judgment, and the executioners are sent through the city, but it's not indiscriminate. They notice those who are mourning sin and they protect them. They put a mark of protection on them. And there's a little echo, I think, of one of our previous studies here, which is back in Exodus 12. Do you want to explain the connection?
Well, so people, marks on foreheads, it makes people think of crazy films about the book of Revelation and the mark of the beast and the mark of the lamb and so on. But the biblical context for it is the Passover, right? So God's judgment's coming, but some houses are marked by the blood of a lamb and God passes over in judgment. And this is an echo of that. God's judgment can be escaped by those who are faithful to him, who trust in him.
And I think that's really important in the apologetic. So is God harsh to judge his people? We thought about this in the last study. Well, firstly, that the judgment is deserved. Just look at the repugnance of their sin, and in the most holy place they're doing despicable things. But also think about how God's judgment is selective. He knows what he's doing, and he does discern between different types of people. He's not unfair in the way he does it.
And then we get to chapter 10, and we find out what the fire was for. So a man clothed in linen is told to go in among the whirling wheels underneath the cherubim. So the underbelly of God's chariot, where I guess it's where the engine is, and take some of this fire, these coals of fire, and scatter them over the city. So this fire becomes a fire of judgment, and fire is rained down on Jerusalem.
Yeah. And there's an exit. So in the last study, we thought about how they're sent out of the land, out of the sight of the Lord. And we're thinking about how it's not just a relocation, but it's a breaking of fellowship. And we get that image in a different way here, where the Lord is leaving his temple. And it does so in a kind of stepwise, delayed and kind of partial way. So initially the glory goes, I think this is chapter 10, verse 4, from the ark cherubim to the threshold of the temple. And so then
to the door, basically.
Yeah, the doorway. And then verse 18, from the threshold to the mobile cherubim. And then it's not till we get to chapter 11, 23 that the glory of the Lord leaves the city. Why do you think we get this stepwise stage process?
Maybe is it like reluctance? I mean, God could just say, right, I'm off. But at every point God is slow to anger, he delays his judgment, and he holds out the possibility of a chance to repent. And I guess it's that kind of vibe that God leaves reluctantly, slowly, but in the end he does.
So it's like the opposite of turning on your heel and slamming the door. It's kind of waiting till the last possible thing, and eventually has to leave. Yeah, I think that's it.
And yet God's glory leaves, but as we saw in chapter 1, he shows up with Ezekiel. So there's even this little hint of hope. I mean, it's again, quite a bleak study like last one, but with a little hint of hope that God is still with those who trust him. And just to reassure listeners to Grace Pod, it's about to get much happier. So Ezekiel, it has a low point when halfway through the book, Ezekiel receives news that the temple has fallen, Jerusalem is destroyed. But from that point onwards, God begins to make promises about how he's going to restore everything, and it's going to get much, much happier. So if you're feeling these have been hard work, these last two, then do stay tuned and let's enjoy the promises of the glory of the gospel and all it will achieve.
And it's worth us reflecting. We said it was like the last study, but it was a change in genre, change in style. And I guess we were political before, now we're ceremonial. We were thinking about sin as disloyalty to a covenant. Now we're thinking of it as defilement. Why do you think we get these two images describing the same thing but from different perspectives?
I think different genres work differently on us, don't they? So 2 Kings was the history, and you get all the history and the dates and everything, and the all straight. And there's no historical details here at all, but you get this glimpse of God at the heart of it. And it's a very God-centered view of what's going on. And I think it engages with our imagination, and it makes us have a bigger view of God. And we understand, well, of course, if that's who God is, he would have to leave. Mm. He couldn't stick around.
And maybe seeing sin, this is maybe for some of us a new idea, that it's defilement, it's repugnant, it's the feeling you get when you open the fridge having been away for a month. It's you want to pull away from it, and this is the really what we should feel at a gut level about our sin. But the Bible's helping us to connect, you know, our emotions to reality. Yeah,
thanks so much for tuning in. Join us for the good news next week. And do subscribe or share if you found it helpful. God bless.
Thank you for listening to Grace Pod. For more information about Grace Church Greenwich, visit www.greenwich.church.